Let's go now to the muscle tissue chapter. Just like we skipped the skeletal system chapter, or the chapter devoted to the actual bones of the skeleton, because that's stuff you learn in lab. Also, we're not in here going to go through the chapter that goes through the names of all the muscles. That's also a laboratory activity. So this is about muscle tissue and how it's constructed, and more difficultly for most people, how it actually operates. So in this opening slide, we're looking at one kind of muscle. How many muscle types are there?
Three.
There are three: skeletal muscle, cardiac muscle, and smooth muscle. By the way, in terms of organ systems, even though there are three kinds of muscle tissue, which is a histological concern, only one of those three types is included in the muscular system. So the muscular system as an organ system includes just skeletal muscle plus the tendons that are associated with those muscles. Cardiac muscle is part of the circulatory system. And smooth muscle is parts of various systems, largely the digestive system. You find a lot of smooth muscle lining the hollow alimentary canal, which is the tube that goes all the way from mouth to anus. But smooth muscle is found elsewhere as well. So only skeletal muscle is officially part of the organ system called the muscular system, but this chapter is not about the organ system, it's about the tissue. And so we'll talk a little bit about all three, but most of the chapter is about skeletal muscle and how it operates. And that's what we're looking at right here. We're looking at a good picture to illustrate what you already know, hopefully, which is that skeletal muscle is striated muscle. The striations are the little pink and white bands that you see. Very regular appearance. What other kind of muscle is striated? Cardiac muscle is also striated. Right, but this is skeletal muscle, and those striations, those little lines, which are positioned transverse with respect to the muscle cell, they occur because of the molecular architecture that we're going to look at that allows skeletal muscles to operate the way they do. Those molecules, well, there are several, but there are two very important ones that really are the chief reason why you see striations, and those are special examples of thin filaments that in the case of muscle cells we call myofilaments. Now, we talked about cytoskeletal structure in this class, didn't we? Did we or didn't we? I actually don't remember. Did we talk about the cytoskeleton and the three kinds of proteins that make up the cytoskeleton? Someone saying yes? So we didn't talk about microtubules, intermediate filaments, and microfilaments? Of course we did. Yeah, those are cytoskeletal proteins, the three chief protein types that make up the cytoskeleton in any kind of animal cell that you would look at. But in the case of skeletal muscle, the microfilaments come in two varieties called thin and thick filaments, or actin and myosin filaments, that we call myofilaments, M-Y-O filaments, because myo means muscle. So whenever you see myo, you should be thinking muscle. As a matter of fact, an individual muscle cell, skeletal muscle cell, actually, any muscle cell, not just skeletal muscle cell, but any individual cell of a muscle can go by any of several names. You can call it a muscle cell, but you can also call it a muscle fiber. When you use that phrase, don't be confused by the fact that fiber is used many different ways. Muscle fiber, that phrase, means exactly the same thing as muscle cell, which means exactly the same thing as myofiber, Myofiber is just another way of saying muscle fiber, because myo means muscle. All right, so those all refer to an entire cell, but only a cell. And I say that because we're going to consider structure at several levels, hierarchical levels. Right? We're looking at just parts of four cells here. The major white lines separate individual myofibers here, individual muscle cells. And not the entire cell is shown in any of these, for any of these four. They're much longer side to side on this slide than what is shown here. So skeletal myofibers are unusual in that respect compared to most cells. Most cells are pretty compact, fairly spherical, not especially long in any of the three dimensions. They're about, you know, they're just compact. Skeletal myofibers, though, can be extraordinarily long. They're as long as a whole muscle is that they are part of. So, for instance, the quadriceps muscles on the front of the thigh, those are pretty long muscles, especially if you have a long thigh, which I don't particularly. But when the tendon ends and the muscle begins, and then before the next tendon ends, that whole distance, which is the length of the whole muscle, individual myofibers are that whole length, which is extraordinarily long for a cell that you normally think of as being microscopic in all three dimensions. Same thing is true of neurons, right? Neurons can be extraordinarily long, like I've already talked about. In the case of skeletal myofibers, the reason they're able to be this long is because they didn't grow from a tiny cell. They actually became long because many cells along that distance developmentally fused together. And so one myofiber starts out as many different precursor cells, each of which has a nucleus in it, like a normal cell. And therefore, when all of these cells, each with one nucleus, fuse together to form one long myofiber, that myofiber now has many nuclei in it because it retains all the nuclei of the constituent cells. And so we say that skeletal myofibers are multinucleate. They have multiple nuclei. And in the case of skeletal myofibers, the nuclei are peripherally placed. They're pushed to the edge, the very edge, which is why you don't see them right in the middle of the cytoplasm like you do in a normal cell. All these dark regions are nuclei, and they're right at the edge because the myofilaments, which is a different word from myofiber, myofilaments are the things that make the striations. Those are subcellular structures, smaller than the cell. Those need to be arranged in a certain way. They need room to operate, and therefore the nucleus gets squeezed to the side, basically. The nuclei do. Now, notice the word endomysium here, which is what the white lines represent. Not the white lines between the striations, but the white lines between individual myofibers. Endomysium is a layer, one of three, of connective tissue that helps organize a muscle. When I say muscle, by the way, that means whole muscle. A whole muscle is a multicellular organ. All right? Muscle and muscle cell are not the same thing. A whole muscle consists of many, many muscle cells or myofibers. All right? There's a bundling that occurs, though, a hierarchical bundling that occurs. And every individual skeletal myofiber, of course, has its own plasma membrane, like any cell. By the way, we give that a different name, even though it is a plasma membrane. We call it the sarcolemma. What did I say? Sarco means? Maybe I didn't.
You did.
I thought I did. Sarco means flesh. Yes, I did. So when we say someone is a flesh eater, what that really means is that they primarily eat skeletal muscle. People that eat meat are eating skeletal muscle when they eat that meat. And so sarco is another word that occurs in different parts when we're talking about muscles. The sarcolemma is just the special name for the plasma membrane. But exterior to that is a connective, thin, very thin connective tissue layer called the endomysium. And notice mys includes that my of myo, indicating muscles. All right? Endomysium, I said, is just one of three layers. I'll tell you about the other two layers when we get to the appropriate pictures. Slide 2 is a picture, even though it looks very elaborate, it looks like it would be many cells big. This is really all just one myofiber. So this is an individual cell, which is why it makes sense that this outermost yellow layer on this cartoon is called the sarcolemma. That's the plasma membrane of what is just one cell here. But notice that inside this one cell, there are bundles of smaller subcellular structures. And those, each bundle, one of which is sticking out here at the left edge, is called a myofibril. Okay, and you have to keep these very similar names straight. The cell itself is the myofiber. The myofiber is really a bundle, just like a cable is a bundle of strands. The myofiber is a bundle of things called myofibrils. Myofibrils are smaller than the cell. They're subcellular. Each myofibril, in turn, is itself a bundle of smaller strands. And you can see some of those smaller strands sticking out of this one myofibril that's sticking out. Those smaller strands are the myofilaments I was talking about. So these are all confusing terminology, right? Myofilaments are much smaller than myofibers because a myofiber is an entire cell. A myofibril is at the molecular level. Myofilaments are molecules themselves. Okay, so myofilaments come in two major types called actin and myosin, and we'll look at the detail of that in a different slide. But that's why there are two different colors here. And notice one of them is thicker than the other in diameter, so that's why we often call them thick filaments and thin filaments. So a collection, an alternating bundle of thick and thin myofilaments make up one bundle called a myofibril. Several more or less identical myofibrils are then bundled together in a bigger bundle called the cell itself, which is the myofiber. That is wrapped, of course, by a plasma membrane, which in this case we call the sarcolemma. Now, in any given animal cell, since they're eukaryotes, you're going to find the normal collection of membrane-bounded organelles, which we've talked about. Those include endoplasmic reticulum, right? That's what we call it just as a general word whenever we're talking about any run-of-the-mill cell. But once again, we give it a special name, just like we specially call the plasma membrane the sarcolemma. We rename the endoplasmic reticulum in the case of a skeletal myofiber and give it the name sarcoplasmic reticulum. All right? Now, the sarcoplasmic reticulum is this network shown in blue here. And that's why it's called a reticulum, by the way. Reticulum means small network. Reti, R-E-T-E, means network. So reticulum means small reti. And that's why, I remember, reticular fibers are called that, because they're branched, forming a network. So this sarcoplasmic reticulum is just a modified, in shape, version of what you would find in any cell, the endoplasmic reticulum. And in the skeletal muscle cell, the sarcoplasmic reticulum takes on a very special job, which is to sequester or store in itself calcium ions. The sarcoplasmic reticulum has a lumen. It is a membrane-bounded organelle, so it is its own compartment. within the cell. Right? It has its own membrane. So inside that membrane, the lumen of the sarcoplasmic reticulum is different stuff compared to the cytoplasm, which is outside of the sarcoplasmic reticulum but still inside the cell. The chemistry of those two fluids is different. The general cytoplasm, or cytosol, which is really just the liquid component of the cytoplasm, has a low concentration of calcium ions normally. The sarcoplasmic reticulum continuously spends energy in the form of ATP to pump, using membrane-bound proteins in its membrane, to pump calcium ions from the cytoplasm into the lumen of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And that's why I say it sequesters them. It collects as many calcium ions as possible, so the calcium ion concentration in the lumen of the sarcoplasmic reticulum is very high. And therefore, there is always a very steep gradient with respect to calcium ions across the sarcoplasmic reticular membrane. Remember that if there's a gradient, then there is a tendency to diffuse, right? That means calcium ions always want to diffuse from the lumen of the sarcoplasmic reticulum through the membrane out into the general cytosol. But remember that one requirement of diffusion, the other requirement besides there being a gradient in place, is that there has to be a way for them to get from A to B, right? And normally, by normally I mean in a non-stimulated muscle cell, those calcium ions are not able to get through the membrane. So they're locked inside the sarcoplasmic reticulum into which they've been pumped. Okay? Notice that every so often you have enlargements of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. The thin network of bags become thicker, more voluminous bags, and those are called terminal cisternae. And notice that the terminal cisternae correspond to the lines of striation. So where you see striations in a microscopic view, like we saw in that opening slide, however many striations there are, that's how many of these terminal cisternae there are going to be. Actually, twice as many terminal cisternae because there's two per striation. Now, I talked a little bit about the sarcolemma, which is just the plasma membrane of the overall cell. But unlike a normal plasma membrane, which is just a smooth outer coating of membrane, the sarcolemma of a myofiber, every now and then, as you travel down the length of the overall long cell, every now and then that sarcolemma will invaginate, cave in. All right? And that will look like a little hole if you looked at this outside surface. That would look like a hole in the sarcolemma. But it's not really a hole. It's just that it wraps into a tunnel that moves toward the interior of the cell itself. And so those little tubes that the overall sarcolemma is forming, it's all continuous membrane, but the tube that it forms when it invaginates is called a transverse tubule because the tube is situated transverse with respect to the length of the myofiber. And there are many, many transverse tubules. There are transverse tubules associated with each of the striations as well. All right, so you can see a transverse tubule labeled here in purple. And notice that it has little cut pieces of tube. Well, those cut pieces, if they weren't cut, would just be continuous with the yellow sarcolemma. So the transverse tubule material, even inside the cell, that's all part of the plasma membrane, sarcolemma. Does that make sense? So that allows us to define a triad. Triad is a general word that means a three-part thing. There are three things included in a myofiber's triad. One transverse tubule, and a terminal cisterna on either side of that transverse tubule. So there's two terminal cisternae and one transverse tubule making up a single triad, and there's a triad for each of the striations. All right. Now, since the transverse tubules are just invaginations of the plasma membrane, or sarcolemma, think about the interior of those transverse tubules. The interior of the transverse tubule is just like the interior of your digestive tract or alimentary canal. That's outside of your body, right? Your body is just wrapped around that tube. Similarly, the inside of a transverse tubule is really outside of the cell. It's continuous with the extracellular fluid that's right here. You see that? So one person sees that? Does that make sense? Well, I'll just go on then. We've been talking about the hierarchical structure from the viewpoint of a cross-section. So we have a whole muscle that in cross-section looks like a bundle of myofibrils, each of which is a bundle of myofilaments. All of those things are running in parallel, side by side. All right? But if you consider, well, and each of them is, myofibrils and myofibrils within a myofiber are just as long as the myofiber itself, just like the strands of a cable individually are just as long as the cable itself. All right, they're just running side by side. But there's also an end-to-end arrangement to this. In other words, a serial arrangement versus parallel. So a myofiber, or actually a myofibril within a myofiber, is actually broken into little end-to-end sections that are the functional unit of skeletal muscle, the smallest part that can actually do what a skeletal muscle does, which is to contract. That's all muscles ever do, right, on their own, is to contract. These little functional units are called sarcomeres. All right? And the distance between striations, when you look at a histological preparation, those are sarcomeres that you're looking at. Sarcomeres are the lengths of the distance between striations. You can also think of them as the distance between one triad and the next one. All right? So you can see Z-disc, I-band, and A-band labeled there. All of those are parts of what we call a sarcomere. We're going to look at a better picture of a sarcomere in a minute, but appreciate that sarcomeres are arranged end-to-end, just like boxcars in a freight train. The overall freight train represents the myofibril. And in this case, you would have many freight trains side-by-side making up the overall muscle cell because there are several myofibrils arranged in parallel. But each individual myofibril is made up of little end-to-end sarcomeres. And it's the sarcomeres that are actually able to shorten. They shorten simultaneously. When one of them shortens, all of the sarcomeres in that myofibril shorten. So if you imagine a train in which the boxcars individually get a little shorter, they don't have to get very short individually for it to add up, if it's a 200-car freight train, to a lot of shortening of the overall train. So each individual sarcomere gets a little bit shorter, but since they're all connected end to end, the overall myofibril gets very much shorter. And the same things within that same cell, all the other myofibrils are doing the same thing at the same time. So the overall cell gets drastically shorter, and that's how muscle cells work. Okay? Let me go on to 3 and take a better look at these myofilaments that we've been talking about. So as I mentioned before, the two major microfilaments, which are proteins responsible for muscular contraction, are myosin and actin. Myosin is shown in A, and notice that myosin molecules make up what are called the thick filaments in purple here. A thick filament is not an individual molecule. An individual myosin molecule is, or an individual myosin protein, is really an example of a dimer, D-I-M-E-R. A dimer is made up of two things. Di means two, mer means part. And so each, the dark purple thing in A and the light purple thing in A, notice they are identical to each other. They're just shown in different colors so you can distinguish them. They're wrapped up with each other to form the dimer that we call one myosin molecule. Each of those slightly different colored purple things is one polypeptide. So you make two identical polypeptides, arrange them with each other with this twisting motion, and you have one multimeric protein called a myosin. And notice that it's kind of golf club shaped. It has a long shaft, and then at one end it has a globular head that comes off from the shaft at some angle. That's really important, that angle, because as we'll see later, that angle is going to be able to change. It's the change in that angle, which is a shape change of that protein, that actually is going to cause the shortening of the sarcomeres and therefore the contraction of the muscle. But right now you're seeing just a myosin molecule in A. When you bundle a bunch of those dimers together so that there's a bunch of them in parallel with their heads all facing one direction, one end, and then you have another bundle just like it with the heads facing in the opposite direction, and you put the two tips of the handles of the golf clubs together with a collection of proteins that we'll see makes up the M line, then you have what is called a thick filament, shown in purple on B. And notice there's many, many myosin heads, as they're called. That's the club end of these golf club-shaped myosins. Many, many myosin heads sticking out from a single thick filament, or myosin myofilament. Thick filament and myosin myofilament are interchangeable terms. All right? Those are the thick filaments. In a myofibril, you have a bunch of thick filaments, but then in the spaces between those thick filaments, if you look at it in cross sections, so the length of it is toward your eyes here, and you're looking at the cross section. Between the myosin thick filaments, you have a bunch of thin filaments. And thin filaments, even though they are thinner, actually are made up of more kinds of molecules than thick filaments. There's three major kinds of proteins making up a single thick or thin filament. One is actin itself. And actin is shown in red. Notice that it's shown as a beaded arrangement, like a necklace made out of beads, a string of beads, in other words. Each individual bead is itself a protein. Okay? So that's a single molecule of actin. And when we talk about a single bead, one molecule by itself, we call that G-actin. G just stands for globular. Globular proteins are compact proteins. So they're not necessarily perfect spheres like in this cartoon, but they're in a compact shape, a glob. Once you have G-actins made, though, you can string them together with covalent bonds. In other words, you can polymerize them. You can use them as subunits to make a polymer, which is multi-subunits long. When you have that strand of many different G-actins, the whole strand is then called F-actin. F just stands for filamentous, meaning like a strand rather than a glob. Okay, so a single F-actin strand is made up of many G-actin monomers. That explains all the red in that part C. So that's one kind of protein. And that actin is the microfilament part of a thin filament. Myosin is a myofilament, and so is actin. But even though we call thin filaments actin myofilaments, a thin filament is more than just actin. Okay, so we've talked about the actin already. The other two players in this game are another filamentous protein, ones shown in white, but that aren't as long, so it takes many of them to go down the length of an F-actin. And those ones are called tropomyosin and the third, shown in yellow here, are called troponin, or some people pronounce it troponin. Either one's fine. Now, the troponin is a kind of a globular protein itself, and so there's many troponins along the length of a thin filament. But each individual troponin has three binding sites on it. Three connection points that it can connect with something else. One of those connection points binds the troponin to a G-actin monomer in red, keeps it in place on the strand. A second binding site of troponin binds it to a tropomyosin molecule in white. The third binding site, those first two that I just mentioned, are more or less permanent. Those are permanent connections. The third binding site is one that can accept, if they are available, calcium ions. Now, calcium ions, when they bind to the binding site of troponin, are acting as what? What is the general word that describes something that binds to something else? A ligand, exactly. So calcium ions are ligands that are able to bind to calcium ion binding sites of troponin. And what did I say is the general result when a ligand binds to a protein? What happens in general? A change in conformation of that protein. Change in shape. Okay? This is what happens with troponin. When it's unbound from calcium, when there's no calcium there, the troponin will be in one shape. If calcium happens to be present and binds to that third site, it's going to change the shape of the troponin. And that, since troponin is connected all the time to both G-actin and tropomyosin, a change in the shape of the troponin is going to change the relationship, the spatial relationship between tropomyosin and G-actin. All right? One thing I didn't tell you about G-actin yet is that each G-actin molecule, each bead in red, also has a binding site on it. And that binding site is called a myosin binding site, because the thing that's able to bind to it is one of these golf club head-shaped myosin heads of a thick filament, which are right beside them, right? Remember the arrangement in the myofibril. You have thin filaments right by thick filaments. So these myosin heads in purple above are right by G-actin molecules, the red beads. And they're therefore right in position to for a myosin head to bind to a myosin binding site on a G-actin. Except, at rest, unstimulated, the tropomyosin in white is going to be in a position that blocks the binding site of the F-actin. And therefore, even though the myosin head is there and is willing to bind to that binding site, it can't get there. The tropomyosin is in the way. Okay? Well, when calcium is present and it binds to the third binding site on troponin, changing the shape of that troponin, what happens is that the tropomyosin, which is also connected to that troponin, gets dragged into a different position so that it no longer is covering the binding sites on the G-actin. It reveals, in other words, these myosin head binding sites of the G-actin, and therefore the myosin heads themselves will bind to the red G-actin. All right? That's the important part of, that's one of the important parts of muscular contraction. Still no muscle has contracted, but that has to happen in order for muscular contraction to occur. All right? So those are the three major components of a thin filament. And in D, we can see the spatial arrangement of thin filaments with respect to thick filaments. So we're looking at a lateral view here along the length. Thick filaments in purple, interspersed with thin filaments, which are in red, white, and yellow. Now notice that bare zone. That's called the bare zone because this is where the tips of the handles, like I was saying, get soldered together with club heads on that end and club heads on this end, but there are no clubs. This is just shaft part of the golf clubs. So that bare zone has no myosin heads to interact with any thin filaments, even if there were thin filaments there. It takes myosin heads to interact with thin filaments. Now to four. We've mentioned the major proteins involved, but they're not the only proteins involved, and these ones have some special importance as well. Notice the thick and the thin filaments in purple and red. The thin filaments are shown just as F-actin, just for simplicity, but the troponin and the troponin and the tropomyosin are there as well. What we haven't talked about are the green ones that look like little springs. Those are elastic filaments, as you see, aptly named because they can be stretched. And then when the force that stretches them is relieved, they'll rebound into their position. The elastic filaments help hold these thick filaments in place. Now the zigzag that you see in brown is a complex of proteins making up what we call the Z-disc. And this Z-disc is one edge of a single sarcomere. The other edge is not shown here. It will be off the screen to the right. But there's going to be another zigzag down here somewhere, which is the right edge of that same sarcomere. So Z-discs are the boundaries between adjacent sarcomeres. One sarcomere goes from one Z-disc to the next Z-disc. And a myofibril will have many Z-discs because a myofibril is made up of many sarcomeres laid end to end. Okay, now the big red one, the green, the blue, and the purple, these are proteins that allow for this internal complex of proteins, the ones we've been talking about already, to be anchored to external, extracellular structures. So notice we have basal lamina and endomysium labeled at the top. That endomysium is that connective tissue layer that I said wraps each individual myofiber, each cell. Well, there are linking proteins, the purple, green, and blue ones, that connect to what is shown in red here called a dystrophin molecule. That's another protein. The dystrophin molecule connects to the myofilaments themselves. And so it itself is kind of a linking protein, but the dystrophin link binds to proteins that actually penetrate the plasma membrane, or sarcolemma. And so this whole complex of proteins, the red, blue, green, and purple, basically make a stress relief connection between the inside of the cell and the outside of the cell. So that when the sarcomeres shorten, they're also pulling on this endomysium. And so all of that stuff gets shorter as well. All right? Let's go on to 5. Now we can see one full sarcomere and a little bit of the sarcomeres on either side of it. But this Z-disc to this Z-disc, that is one sarcomere. Now, notice that we have Z-disc, A-band, H-band, M-band. These structures were named by the first people to figure this out, which were Germans. And so the Z-disc is called the Z-disc because it's short for Zwischenscheibe, which is spelled just like it sounds. You don't have to spell it. You don't have to spell it. But it just means disc between. Zwische in German means between. That's why it's called that. And M stands for Mittel, which is German for middle, you might have guessed. So the M line is a complex of proteins, but it's right in the middle of the Z disc, and that's what holds all these purple thick filaments in place. All right? Now you have bands, H band, I band, and A band. Well, the I band and the A band get their name based on how polarized light is affected by these pieces. And it doesn't matter if you understand. I don't want you to memorize this, but that's just how they got their name. The light that comes off of these sections is changed differently in these two different kinds of bands. So the I stands for isotropic and the A stands for anisotropic. But don't worry about that. I'm just telling you the history of it. I bands and A bands are different from each other, though, based on what is included in them. All right? So notice that the A band is exactly the length of the thick filaments. That's what the A band is defined as. The length of that whole bundle of thick filaments in that one sarcomere. The I band, on the other hand, is everywhere where you don't have any thick filaments. So notice that there are some thin filaments in the I band, but that's not really what makes it the I band. What makes it the I band is that there aren't any thick filaments in this region. Also notice that the A band is centered on the M line, and one A band is entirely within a sarcomere. Whereas an I band is centered on a Z disc, and therefore half of the I band is in one sarcomere, and half of that same I band is in the next sarcomere. Right? See that? You also have the H band, which stands for hell, which is German for bright. The H band, notice, is the part of the A band where there are no thin filaments also there. So thick and thin filaments overlap each other, notice, and in part of the A band, but in part of the A band that you find only thick filaments and no overlapping thin filaments. That's what makes it the H band. Now, sarcomeres contract, like I said. They get shorter. But they do this without either kind of myofilament, thick or thin, themselves getting shorter. So the myofilaments do not contract. The reason that the sarcomere contracts, though, is because the degree of overlap between the two types of myofilaments is increased or decreased. So if I put my fingers together like this, and my thumbs represent Z-discs, and my fingers represent the different kinds of myofilaments, without shortening my actual fingers, I can increase the overlap between them, and that decreases the distance between my thumbs. Okay? That's what's happening in a sarcomere. The thin and thick filaments, the myosin, which is the thick, and the actin myofilament, which are the thin, increase in their overlap without either one of them getting shorter. And when that happens, since the thin filaments are anchored at one end to a Z-disc, and the thin filaments at the other end of the sarcomere are anchored to the other Z-disc, when that increase in overlap occurs, that means the Z-discs move toward each other. And notice when that happens, that increase in overlap is going to make the H-band, which is where there is no thin filaments, it's going to make it smaller. Because that increase in overlap is going to bring these thin filaments closer and closer to the M line. Everyone clear on that? Yeah. Correct. And the A band itself is always the same size because the myosin thick filaments do not change their length. They don't contract. The A band, on the other hand, gets smaller during contraction because the increased overlap between thick and thin filaments means there's less of a length at which you find no thin filament overlap. It can effectively disappear, but I'm going to talk later about why there's limits to contraction and to extension. All right, that's the anatomy of a sarcomere. Let's go on to 6 and talk more about the hierarchical structure, the hierarchical anatomy of a whole muscle. We've talked about the hierarchy that occurs just within one cell. But a cell is just part of the hierarchy that makes up an entire whole muscle. All right, so at the top of slide 6, you have a whole muscle. Whole muscles are the things that get their own names, like biceps brachii for this one that allows me to flex the elbow. That's a whole muscle. Okay, that whole muscle is itself a bundle of parallel elements. In the case of a whole muscle, the major bundles that it's made up of are called fascicles. That's the anglicized word. Some books will call a fascicle a fasciculus. It means the same thing. So fasciculus, fasciculi for plural, same thing as fascicle or fascicles. Multiple fascicles, though, which are bundles running side by side, the whole length of the whole muscle, however many fascicles there are, those make up the entire whole muscle. All right, remember we said that the epimysium is a connective tissue layer that surrounds each individual myofiber, which is a cell. It takes several myofibers running side by side, bundled together, to make up one fasciculus or fascicle. And fascicles are separated from each other within a whole muscle by a second kind of connective tissue layer. That's a layer that wraps just the entire fascicle. And that connective tissue layer is called paramecium. As you can see labeled in A, or at the very top picture, paramecium. Peri meaning around. So it goes around a single fascicle. Then you have several fascicles making up the whole muscle. And the whole muscle itself is wrapped in connective tissue. And that's the third word that I started talking about long ago. So that tissue, connective tissue layer covering the whole muscle and therefore keeping it separate from other whole muscles with other names is called epimysium. All right, so there's one epimysium per whole muscle. There's several paramycia, one for each fascicle within that. And then there's many more endomycia, because there's one per myofiber, many per fascicle. All right, that's the stranded hierarchy for a whole muscle. The rest of it we've already discussed. All of those things I was just now discussing on this slide, those are the full length of the muscle. Right? The whole muscle, of course, is the full length of the muscle. The fascicles are the full length of the muscle. The myofibers making up the fascicles are the full length. The myofibrils within each myofiber are the full length. But each myofibril is made up of shorter sarcomeres that are then arranged end to end. So it takes many sarcomeres to make up the whole length of a myofibril. Right? And in each sarcomere are the two kinds of myofilaments. Myosin myofilaments, or thick filaments, and actin myofilaments, or thin filaments. Anchored, well, the thick filaments are anchored to the M line, one M line per sarcomere, and the thin filaments are anchored at one end to either of the two Z discs that define the boundaries of that one sarcomere. Everyone clear on all that? All right, well then let's go to 7. What we're looking at here is the notion of motor units. Now, as I've already described it, a whole muscle is many, many cells big, right? Each cell has the capacity to contract. That's one of the hallmarks of muscle tissue. At the cellular level, muscle tissue has contractility, right? It's able to contract. And as I keep saying, that's all it does actively on its own, is get shorter. A muscle does not expend energy. It can't forcibly get long. But muscle tissue also, in addition to being contractile, having contractility, has extensibility, which means it can be stretched also without damaging it, up to a limit, of course. But some outside force is what is extending it. The muscle is not getting long on its own. It's being stretched by some other force. Now, that other force might be because of the contraction of an antagonistic muscle doing the opposite thing. For instance, when I use my triceps brachii, when it contracts to extend the elbow, it's going to stretch or extend the cells in my biceps brachii. But it's not the biceps brachii on its own that's getting longer. The muscle cells can only shorten on their own. So there's contractility, there's also extensibility. What else have we already said about muscle cells? What? They are excitable as well. So contractility, extensibility, and excitability are three very important aspects of muscle cells in general, including skeletal muscle cells. So you have this bundle of many myofibers making up a whole muscle. That whole muscle's overall strength is a function of how many muscle cells there are. You know, there are big muscles and there are small muscles in the body. The biggest muscles are the ones that have the most number of individual myofibers. But in any given muscle, at any given moment, not all of the myofibers are contracting at the same time. So you don't have to use the full strength of a muscle, as you know from experience. When you are just using a muscle at partial strength, what you're really doing is just causing a small subset of the overall number of myofibers in that whole muscle to contract. All right? Now, another important thing about skeletal muscles, muscle cells compared to the other kinds, is that skeletal muscle cells do not contract on their own. They do not have autorhythmicity. They have to be spurred into contraction by receiving a chemical message from a neuron. That chemical message is in the form of a neurotransmitter. So unless a neuron that innervates or connects to the myofiber releases a neurotransmitter, then that muscle cell is not going to create an action potential and it's therefore not going to contract. You can artificially do it by applying an electrical voltage to it, but naturally it's not going to contract unless a neuron tells it to, okay, for skeletal muscle. So when you decide to only use your muscle at partial strength, what you are really doing is using your nervous system to fire only certain neurons that are connected to just a small subset of the overall number of myofibers making up that whole muscle. And I'll explain further what motor units mean next time.